floor. And in showing this slide, I think I really ought to pay homage to two figures of Southern California who have had a very strong influence on my own life and work, and who are no longer with us. One was Charles Eames, the designer in Southern California, and he had his office in Venice. And it was with Charles Eames that I took this particular picture. He had gone with me to Uppsala in order to work for a great exhibition about Copernicus, which had been subsequently was used by IBM and has occasionally been shown again since then. And the other person I think of is, of course, someone who was very instrumental in helping the collection here, and that's Jake Zeitlin. And it was Jake who was always so extremely generous in giving me information about where to find particular books and in collections and in obscure places, sneaking into places in wonderful ways, so on. And he was also very helpful and very influential. So in showing the slide of Copernicus's library, I think of both of those people, a bookman and somebody who taught me a great deal about photography and how to view things. Well, now I want to go on. Here is the man I spoke of before, a rather youthful portrait of him. He's bright-eyed, his mustache, that's Tycho Brahe, the man who decided to reform astronomy. That's when, as a teenager, he made an observation of a great conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn and saw that the very best of tables based on Copernicus were wrong by over a day. And those based on the Alphonsine tables were even worse, so he decided that he would devote his life to getting measurements so astronomy could be reformed. And it was with giant instruments, such as this mural quadrant, that Tycho was able, finally, to get the observations of sufficient precision to tell the difference between a circle and an ellipse. Now, Tycho says that, well, this instrument was basically just a wall, with a slit up there in the top where the light of the star can come in, and a very, very large, stable, calibrated measuring quadrant. But he says he doesn't want to waste the space in his book, so he shows a painting on the wall with himself, his alchemical laboratories, his library, his students, the assistants out making the observations, and all of it. In fact, we can see a typical view of the students making the observations here with a sextant, with an armillary sphere, and with a quadrant. So with these wonderful kinds of instruments, he was able to get up a set of observations the likes of which the world had not seen before. And here is indeed one of those books of observations, which were to become of paramount importance to a young astronomer who came to visit him eventually. And I'm sorry the slide is so dark. This is one of those authentic images of Johannes Kepler, almost a baby-faced young man, but this is very much how he looked at the time he came to work for Tycho Brahe. The little miniature of Kepler and his new wife on a matching one is now in Leningrad. I don't know what the Russians did to my film, whether the x-ray sort of zapped it or something, but anyway, it made it come out a little bit dark, and I have to recopy it, I think, if I want to use it. But anyway, there's Kepler, when he came to work for Tycho Brahe. He had been a high school teacher in Graz, in southern Austria, and while teaching his class one day, a startling notion came to him about why there are six planets. Six planets in the Copernican system. Because he had gone to Tübingen and studied with Michael Messlin and had come away a convinced Copernican. So if he had been a Ptolemaist, he would have counted the Sun and Moon, as well as Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn, as seven planets. But as a Copernican, he had only the Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, the Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. He had six planets. And there are five platonic solids, the regular solids, like a cube with square faces and a tetrahedron and so on. And what he discovered, for example, was if he had a sphere here for Mars, and he put a dodecahedron inside with its vertices just touching, and then the face is touching the sphere for the Earth, it just fit okay. But let me see. Oh, yes, the tetrahedron is out on the other side of Mars. Inside the Earth, you have an icosahedron, and it separates the Earth from Venus. And then inside, if you cheat a little bit, you get an octahedron just nesting in there to separate between Venus and Mercury. And it was all wonderful, and it didn't quite work, but it worked just well enough to convince him that it was something great. Worked within 10%. And he made a book about it, and he sent copies off to various people, including Tycho Brahe up in Denmark. Tycho saw that here was somebody who had a great imagination, a great ability to work with mathematical figures, including in three dimensions, and so he promptly invited Kepler up to work with him, but Kepler said this was way too far, there was no possibility of going up. But he said it was part of divine providence that Tycho would leave from Denmark and come down to Prague. He didn't say that it was also divine providence that the Counter-Reformation swept in and all the Protestant teachers were given till sundown to leave. But that was also part of what happened to Kepler, and so he was moved up to Prague. He was without a job, and Tycho took him in as a subordinate. Kepler wasn't quite prepared for that because he thought he was a pretty good astronomer and should be considered part of the regular staff, not that low down. Tycho was extremely secretive, but would occasionally hand out some observations, and here in Kepler's notebook, he has got one of these precious observations from Tycho, so precious, in fact, that he puts the double line around it so that he can always get back and find it again. What Kepler did was an ingenious plan to try to work out the orbit of Mars, because at that time, Tycho and his chief assistant were very much worried about Mars. Mars is the planet that comes closest. No, it isn't. It doesn't come as close quite as Venus does. But it comes close enough, and you can get a complete set of observations. But also, it has a pretty eccentric orbit. You can see that by the way in which you have a circular orbit here for the Earth and a circular orbit for Mars, but which is considerably off space, off center. And that is the eccentricity of the Martian orbit. And Kepler then said that it was, again, divine providence that Tycho was at work on Mars, because it's only from Mars that you can get the secrets of the heavens. And here you can see how he is going to tease out this information. Mars moves around more slowly than the Earth, and he knew that if the Earth was here and he was observing Mars, that as the Earth goes around here and gets back to the same point again, Mars will have got over here someplace. That after 587 days, Mars will get back to the same place where it was. The Earth will have gone not quite around a second time and will have got over to here. And so if you happen to have an observation that is made exactly 587 days later, you know Mars was in the same place, and you can get a triangulation. And this is a very lucky situation, because he was able, from Tycho's observations, to get out five of those observations of Mars at successive intervals, with the Earth here, 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 and here. And in triangulating to Mars, what he then found, and what you can see in his book, is that Mars didn't travel in a perfect circle, because the triangulation showed that Mars was inside the circle. And this was the first time, then, that there was a sufficient base of observations to see that maybe a perfect circle wasn't what was going to be required. But what was required? In the standard mythology, it says, well, Kepler just got all these wonderful observations from Tycho, went merely triangulating around, found all the points, and then fit a curve through them. But alas, life was not that simple. The observations of Tycho were good, but not that good. And there were errors in them,
And so there was a continual scatter of where it was falling. Kepler said eventually that it was a method of votes and ballots. You couldn't just fit the curve through. You had to see sort of which way it was going. Now I want to come back to what it was that Kepler could do in order to get to the ellipse. But at this point, we have a digression. Since you're a bookish crowd, I thought I would tell you a little something about chasing after rare books, because surprisingly, this comes back around to give some interesting insight into what it was that Kepler was up to. And I think many of you know, because I have spoken to the friends before, about my search after copies of Copernicus's book, the De Revolutionibus, which was published in 1543, and the second edition in 1566. And here I have come to a collector in Connecticut with my colleague Jerzy Dobczynski from Warsaw. There is Harrison Horblett, who owned this fabulous copy of Copernicus's book, first edition, and we're having a look at it. And what Dobczynski noticed right away was that here, where there is a Greek poem written in the flyleaf, that this was exactly the same text, only in Greek, that appeared in Kepler's copy of the book. The only thing is, in this particular copy, it is all written out, and so there's another page of it. It's an interesting poem. And it is signed at the end, Joachim Camerarius, with an iota and a kappa. Now, Camerarius was a professor of languages at Leipzig. He's the top professor at the University of Leipzig. And in addition to teaching there, I suppose he was the man to get to write a Greek poem for the front of your book. I mean, he was publishing these Greek dedicatory poems in one book after another. And I suspect that young Rheticus, the man who had got the manuscript from Copernicus and had brought it to Nuremberg to publish, asked Camerarius if he wouldn't write a nice Greek poem to go at the front of Copernicus's book. And I suspect this is the poem he wrote. It's a wonderful poem, a Platonic type of dialogue between a philosopher and a stranger. And the stranger, "What is this new book I see?" And the philosopher said, "Well, it's a new one." And the stranger says, "Is there anything good in it?" And the philosopher says, "Take a look and see." And so on. And it ends up by saying, "Don't be like the unlearned and just dismiss this out of hand. See it if you are critical of it, if you can do it any better." But Rheticus left Nuremberg, where the book was being published, and went down to Leipzig to take up a teaching position, and the publication of the book, including the front matter, fell into other hands, and the Greek poem was never included in the book. So Rheticus asked Camerarius to write his poem in the book anyway, and this is the copy that Rheticus sent to the dean back at the University of Wittenberg. What Dobczynski then recognized was that the poem matched the one that is in Kepler's own copy. Here is Kepler's copy of the book. Here you can see, just faintly over here on the side, the poem in Latin, and it's signed I.K., which everyone supposed stood for Johannes Kepler, but not quite. It says Vertit, which means translated, and this is one of those wonderful kind of puns that Kepler always liked. It stands not only for Johannes Kepler, but it's also the iota kappa for Joachim Camerarius, the man who had written the original in Greek. In the course of trying to find every possible copy of Copernicus's book, I went to the library in Parma, and they couldn't find their first edition. They even showed me the place, the hole on the shelf where it belonged. Well, I figured that somebody just had it out, was using it in some office or someplace. But I mentioned it to my colleague, Robert Westman, who's here in San Diego and is moving now to teach at La Jolla. And he said, that's funny. It was also missing a year ago when I asked about it. So I said, And I wrote to them and I said, if it's still missing, please send me a Xerox of the entry in the catalog. It was still missing, and they sent me the entry in the handwritten catalog, which I had vaguely remembered. It said, this is a copy with a Greek poem written in the front of it by Joachim Camerarius. And I thought, aha, this copy that Harrison Hoglett had very mysteriously appeared on the market just after World War II, and I thought, this is the pretty description of this book. Well, the book was auctioned for a princely sum at that time, at least. It was $100,000 for that copy, and subsequently advertised for $150,000. It was eventually bought by another book collector, and I asked the other collector to bring it by sometime. And he did. He brought it to my office, and I said, let's go down to this closet down the hall. It's absolutely pitch black. And I got out my ultraviolet light, and we put it all over, because this is an interesting way to bring up any ink that has been erased or any traces of shelf marks or so on. Book was absolutely clean. Not a shred of evidence that it had ever been in the Parma library. But it seemed to me that the evidence was inescapable. Now, the reason I tell this story on myself is to just show you how dangerous it is to jump to conclusions. Because a couple of years ago, a book dealer in Paris told me that he was on the trail of an extremely interesting copy of Copernicus's book because of the material that was written in it. And when I went to see him, he showed me Xeroxes, and to my great surprise, it was exactly that Greek poem in the same hand of Camerarius and signed by Camerarius. But it was a different copy because the break in the line between the one side of the page and the other was different. I said, this is very, very interesting, and I told him about the Parma Library. And he said, Well, he said, this book has a problem. Said, I received this mysterious phone call from somebody asking me if I was interested in this collection of books in a private collection in Italy. And I said, okay, fine. And they said, well, we'll get in touch with you. And the next thing that happened was that this big pack of Xeroxes had arrived in the mail with no return address. And nobody had ever got back in touch with him. So we know the book exists, but we haven't a clue where it is, other than it is in some private collection in Italy. And it seems to me that if you're going to have to pick which was the copy stolen from the Parma Library, well, it's probably not the one that is in the hands of Haven O'More. So at any rate, in looking elsewhere into this copy of the book owned once by Kepler, there are some very interesting manuscript notes in it. And one would assume that this was in fact put in by Kepler. Although not quite, because the handwriting here is not Kepler's, it's somebody else. It's noticing this. And then there's another little handwriting patch in a different hand. And interestingly, that hand turns out to be Michael Mestler's. So Kepler took the book around to his teacher, and his teacher wrote this little note in it when they were looking at the book. This passage in particular says that there is some question as to whether the center of the universe is the center of the Earth's orbit or the sun itself. Now, all astronomers up through Copernicus basically used the center of the Earth's orbit as the reference point for the solar system. And the first thing that Kepler did when he came to work for Tycho was to say, can I use the sun itself as the reference point? Because I think this is physically more important, as the sun must be the driving force that makes the planets go around, and therefore one should use not this empty space, which is the center of the Earth's orbit, but one should use the sun. And this turned out to be a crucial first step that Kepler took. And it's interesting that in the copy of the book that he happened to get, exactly that is the part that was highlighted. But even more so, there is a place where Copernicus is describing his particular mechanism, which doesn't, with the combination of circles, yield quite a true circle as the result. In fact, what it yields is, and this is written in Greek, an ellipsis. Now again, one would suppose this was Kepler's note, and so on, accepting that by searching for so many copies of Copernicus's book, I've discovered that this is a family of notations which exists, various parts of the notations, in five copies. And they were all put in the book at the time, early on, before Kepler was born. So by chance, the copy of Copernicus's book that Kepler obtained was one which had a few prior annotations put in it at the critical points for where Kepler's own astronomy would take its point of departure. I think this is a fantastic fact. It must be telling us something about the psychology of discovery. But otherwise, I don't know what to do with it, so I simply show it to you as being something fantastic. Let's go back now to the previous line of thought so I can get it all wound up. Here is what Kepler was doing. He knows that he doesn't have a circular orbit, but what is it? How can he come to a final representation for the motion of Mars? Kepler believes that the Sun is in some way providing the driving force that keeps the planets going around. But that doesn't tell him why they are moving in an orbit that is sometimes close to the Sun and sometimes far from the Sun. But he knows that there is one thing that can sort of reach across empty space and have its influence, and that's magnetism. So that if you want the Sun somehow driving the planets around, and yet there aren't any linkages between the Sun and the planet, maybe it is an invisible linkage of magnetism. Ah, but when you've got magnetism and magnets, you have things like a compass that has a north and south pole. So perhaps this is the magnetic axis of the planet, and as it comes up like this, there's a repulsion driving it away from the Sun's magnetism. The effect is to push it farther away, and then it's in a neutral position again, and then the head comes in and is attracted to the Sun so that it moves here, it's pulled back in. Can it be that the magnetism can do this? And when you work out the projection like this from an axis, the simplest curve that you get in the first approximation turns out to be an ellipse. And so that's why Kepler chooses an ellipse as a possibility to fit through these points that he's got from the triangulation. It's sort of uncanny that he stumbles across the right curve for mostly the wrong reasons, but he gets it. What's going on here? It looks sort of like a whiskey bottle that's floating or something, but actually that's a rudder. It's the rudder of the planet guiding itself around in this magnetic effluvium. And here you can see, in fact, the boatman with the boat. And Kepler says it's sort of like a boat in an amusement park which goes back and forth because of the current. And today in Basel, there's exactly such a boat going across the Rhine. Here's the cable that stretches across the Rhine. Here's the pulley, which then is connected down to the boat. So the boat itself has no power. It's just that the boatman sets the rudder so that the flow of the Rhine drives the boat one way across, and then the ferryman changes it to the other setting, and the boat comes back again, being constrained by the pulley. That's how Kepler worked it out, as the rudder of the planet that drives it close and then far from the Sun. Here it is all done with all the geometry for how the magnetism works out. An ellipse it is, and here is the girl on the chariot with the laurel wreath riding up to crown him for thinking of such a neat idea. And here indeed is the ellipse as it is taken over by Isaac Newton. One of these manuscripts, it turns out to be absolutely key to the idea of universal gravitation and the way in which gravitation works, with an inverse square law, and of course then in Newton's hands there are all the apparatus for coming out with the idea of conservation of angular momentum, the moment of the quantity of motion, as Newton called it. But to go to Newton would be to take us too far beyond the present line of argument. I only wanted to get you to Kepler to once more say that when the observations of sufficient accuracy were finally available, the ellipse came very, very quickly. The lack of an ellipse with Copernicus or Ptolemy was not an issue of contention, because they simply couldn't have got to an ellipse. They didn't have these observations of 1 and 2 minutes of arc accuracy, which were essentially needed in order to get there. So anyway, that's my story, the story of the circles of the gods, which I think weren't all that bad for their own time and occasion. Thank you.
I want to make correct an omission. President Day was not able to be here today, and he is ably represented by Vice President for Academic Affairs, Al Johnson. We need now to test the speed of our transport and get over to the Faculty Staff Center before the punch warms.